even if I were writing about this today, I'm not sure I'd be able to pinpoint and measure, you know, how it developed. But I do know that when the players first approached me about becoming the first executive director, sure, I had been a baseball fan ever since I was a small boy, but I decided there was much I did not know. And so I began to read everything I could. And I remember my feelings at the time of that it was a feeling of indignation.
Yeah.
in reading about the reserve clause, for example.
Or Charles Comiskey.
Yeah, or Charles Comiskey, right. And I wasn't reading just texts. I was reading Bill Veeck. I was reading Hustler's Handbook and Veeck's in Rec, and picking up the flavor. And as I say, my strongest memory about that time is a feeling of why didn't I know all this? It's really indignation is justified here.
Yeah.
And the point you made about making it a moral issue, I think, came from a legitimate, sincere feeling that this was immoral behavior.
Yeah.
Now, as you know, this was already well after the barring of African Americans was at an end. But it all reminded me of here was this cherished American institution which had gone so long operating on a thesis that if you broke what they called the color line, the world would collapse. It not only was immoral, it made me think that they really, the powers that be that had kept that color bar in for so long really didn't understand.
Yeah. Well, one form of indenture, right? They were both indentured.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the players were indentured economically, and it wasn't racial.
Yes.
So talk about that. Before we leave, your experience with the steelworkers, there must have been some mentors, some people who taught you and from whom you took some important lessons you implied later, and maybe you talk about them a little bit.
Yes, well, starting with the beginning at the steelworkers in the spring of 1950, my immediate superior was Otis Brubaker, who was the director of research. And I had known him from the War Labor Board days and admired him, exceedingly bright, a dedicated trade unionist in every way, and one of the hardest working people I have ever met. I'd get to work early and he'd be there, and I'd go home late and he'd still be there. And I think I learned a lot of good work habits from him, and, as well as other things. I did not get to know Philip Murray well. It was only a little over 2 years before, after I came, that he died. But I got to know David McDonald, who was president for most of the rest of my tenure there. And I think he may have been one of the most underestimated men and trade union leaders I've ever known, because I don't know how this happened, but he was basically painted in the press as a handsome would-be actor. He was both those things. And as someone not very effective as a trade unionist, and the latter was just simply not true. He was extremely effective, and he really liked everything that he about the job, and I don't know about particular skills that I learned from him, but I think. Almost certainly I learned how to relate to people better.
Wasn't it, tell me if I'm right about this, but my sense is that a trade unionist, somebody in your position, was not just doing a job. There was more to it than making a living. And you speak to that because, again, 50 years from now, people will not understand. There was a quasi-religious, there was a certain amount of passion, there was indignation, there was sense of, you put the word, but moral dimension to it. And I want you to sort of tell people what it was like in those days.
Yes. Well, I think, I'm not sure it would have mattered if I had never worked for a trade union. I had the feeling from other experiences, from the Depression, from my father's work experiences, from my difficulty in finding work after I got out of college, I had the feeling that this society had a great many injustices that had to be corrected. It's true, when you work for a union, it's more or less in your face all the time, the inequities and the injustices, more than if you're in a more routine job. But it is true that, not just of me, of all the people I've ever known who worked for unions, in 99.9% of the cases, in my experience, it was far more than a job. These were people, you have to remember that those of us who worked at the top level of negotiations had as counterparts vice presidents of major corporations. Usually a vice president is the director of industrial relations of the United States Steel or Bethlehem. And you were dealing with those people and their assistants whose salaries, I suppose, were roughly 50 times ours. And I'm not exaggerating. And in all that time, although I know of many people who were solicited by major steel companies for jobs, I know of none who ever took it.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah. And
you didn't cross that street.
I'm sorry?
One didn't cross that street.
Exactly right. And it's not that anybody put pressure on them. It came from inside.
Now, take us to baseball. Now you're at the Steelworkers. What is the first...
If you just excuse me a minute.
Sure.
I kind of feel I didn't fully answer your question about influences on me. I think Arthur Goldberg, who was the general counsel of the Steelworkers Union.
And a great hero of mine.
Yeah. Was obviously an important influence. I worked closely with him for so many years. And it only ended when John Kennedy was elected president and Arthur became Secretary of Labor in January of 61.
Yep.
Arthur was an important leader of the union, and a way that most general counsels are not in American unions. His was a role that went far beyond being the chief legal officer.
And he brought to it passion as well. I mean, his was not just a job.
Oh, absolutely.
That reminds me of a question, though. As you came along, you obviously picked up an awful lot of knowledge of the labor law itself, did you not?
That's, I mean, true.
People have often thought of you as a lawyer.
I know.
But you're not a lawyer in this.
I am not a lawyer, I'm an economist.
But you are very knowledgeable, and I'm sure Arthur had something to do with that.
Well, of course. But also the nature of the work, you know, starting with labor law itself, you better learn a good deal about it in order to be able to operate in that genre. And inevitably, you get into related matters like antitrust and so on. And you get into pension law, and you get into all kinds of things. But and it wasn't just Arthur. He had put together a really stellar legal department. David Feller, who was one of his associates, yeah, who is now gone, really a great lawyer. Elliot Bredhoff, also, who unfortunately is now ill. And Tom Harris. The entire legal staff was really a very superior one. You asked about the segue from there to baseball. And, as I mentioned, I had been with the steelworkers at this point in the end of 1965. I had been there more than 15 years, going on 16. And I was attending a meeting in California. I was involved with a Kaiser Steel tripartite committee. And the chairman of the committee was Dr. George Taylor, who had been the chairman of the National War Labor Board during World War II, who was an economics prof at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. And out of a clear sky in an elevator, he asked me, do you know Robin Roberts? And I said, no, but I know who he is. You know, one of the great pitchers of our time. And why did you ask? And he said, well, I'm not sure I know all the facts, he said, but Mr. Roberts called me. I don't know him. And he said something about they've got an organization of players in baseball that has never been able to do anything for them. It's been controlled and financed by the owners, and they want to change it. They've got a committee they call a search committee, and they're looking for somebody to experience to be the first executive director, and so on. He wanted to know if I'd be interested, and I said, I don't know, but I'd certainly be willing to talk to him. Too. And from that came a meeting at in December of 65 in Cleveland with Robin Roberts and Jim Bunning and Harvey Keene. And that began another phase of my education about baseball. I don't know how much detail you want me to...
Well, why don't you start telling us about... I think the early days are very important. Again, thinking about people 50 years from now, maybe you could just explain how bad things were for the baseball players in sure. those days and why they wanted you.
Yeah. Well, you have to remember, I was talking to really three stars of the game. Bunning had already pitched no-hit games in both leagues and had struck out a thousand or more batters in each league, and Roberts' record as a pitcher for the lowly Phillies was marvelous. And Harvey
Keene, and two of the three went to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and Harvey Keene had been an American League batting champion.
Great hitter, yeah.
Right. So they weren't the most downtrodden of the players by any means, but. The meeting was a peculiar one in the sense that I was doing my best to find out what problems they had and how they viewed them and what they thought they could get out of a more solid organization. And the harder I tried, the less information I got. They seemed focused on the pension plan.
Yeah, the pension seemed to be it, yes.
Yeah. And it was hard for me to understand this. You know, in the Steelworkers Union, There was interest in pensions, but only by the older, more senior workers who were up there in the 60s and so on. Young steel workers couldn't care less. And here were people who were relatively young, and all they could talk to me about was pensions.
But you now understand, because in those days they were worried about what they were going to do for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely.
And they were petrified of the fact that they'd be unemployed at age 35.
And worse than that, without experience that any of their contemporaries right. had piled up exactly. in the business world. In addition, what I came to understand is that the pension plan, which I found to be most inadequate, was nevertheless the one accomplishment they felt that they had achieved. And they felt it was threatened at that point in time. Pension plan had been financed by a share of the television money from the All-Star Game and the World Series. And the value of those two attractions was getting more and more apparent, and television money was moving up and up. And
let me, I think it's important too, the pension plan only covered players who played from a certain date in baseball, am I correct? You
yes.
tell people, but I mean it's very important that yeah. if you played in the 30s or 40s, right. you were not in this plan.
Right, because there was no pension plan, and this one dated from April 1st, 1947. And when it was first established and the players felt that this was a major accomplishment, I guess it was.
It was.
It was clear that they didn't have enough money to have anything except the most pitiful benefits. And it was suggested to them that they had better start from scratch. And so here was this plan, which was going into effect April 1st, 47, and they agreed with the owner's people that the only people to be covered were those who had been on a major league roster on the last day of 1946 or the first day of the 1947 season. Now, to give you some idea of how drastic that was, you could have a 20-year major leaguer who was released late in the 46 season, and he was not eligible.
Yeah.
And they cut them off.
Also, it meant that anybody who played in the Negro Leagues and who was excluded until 1947 was by definition
absolutely
not covered.
Absolutely. And then, in addition, you needed 5 years of major league service after that point to be eligible for a pension.
But again, for historical purpose, there were no health benefits. We're not talking about what you and I know today. This was strictly a pension plan.
No, excuse me, Faye. There were some health care benefits.
Okay.
There was some maternity benefits. There was some hospitalization. There was no dental benefits, no right. eye benefits, no. Having known something about baseball conditions, but more than that, having done a cram job just before this meeting with the search committee, I was amazed that until I brought it up, nobody talked about the reserve clause. Now, for people down the road, let me explain what that meant. Under the reserve clause, players came into the game mostly by being drafted by a major league organization, as if the major league organization were the government. In most cases, it was when you came out of high school, so you were of quite tender years. Some few players went to college in those days, but not many. And so, having been scouted, your name would be placed in a draft, And you had no say about who was going to pick you. And a major league organization would, in the course of the draft, select John Doe. And they would then try to sign you to a contract. Agents were not allowed. It was considered to be perfectly fair to draft a kid out of